My name is Frank Weltner, and I am the librarian of GeeWatch, and I am here to welcome you to the world today. This has been a very, very bad month for Israel. It started with Ariel Sharon having two strokes and becoming comatose, and he'll probably never wake up. Then came the election. It became obvious to the Israelis, to the United States, to England, to everyone, that Hamas was probably going to either win or win enough to make things difficult for Israel. Then when the election finally came, Hamas won in a landslide. The Israelis almost told Hamas they couldn't run, because they did not recognize the right of Israel to exist, that Israel would therefore, being in charge of the Palestinian occupation, would just not let them vote. Well, the world looked at Israel as a democracy and said, well, you're not much of a democracy if you're not going to let the people vote for the candidates that they want. And so Israel finally had to relent, because basically Fatah and Hamas said they weren't going to have an election if Hamas couldn't run. And so Israel relented and allowed them to run. And then the Palestinian people spoke and told Israel, we don't even want you here anymore. We want you out of this desert, off of this land, and as far away as you can possibly swim. We've had 100 years of you since the turn of the century you've been coming in here. You've made our lives miserable, and we don't want anything to do with you. Israel is like a frightened child, and its government is hunkered down, caught off guard by the landslide, after its vaunted intelligence services predicted a slim victory for Mohamed Abbas's Fatah party. Israel's security agencies had relied to some extent on the same Palestinian polls and opinion makers that led the media astray. Foreign Ministry spokesman Mark Regev noted that Palestinians and the international community were also taken by surprise. He said, we're not more wrong than anyone else. Of course, he didn't say how wrong that might be or how not wrong that might be, but obviously it was wrong enough. After the enormity of the Hamas win, they garnered 76 of 132 parliament seats. Prime Minister Ehud Olmert instructed normally talkative cabinet ministers not to speak to the media without permission. For a three-hour emergency session of the security cabinet, Olmert issued a brief statement that Israel would not negotiate with a Palestinian government that includes Hamas ministers, Hamas being the winner of the election. So here you have this great democracy, Israel, saying the people should speak, and when the people speak, we respect that. Well, the people spoke, and they said, we want you off of this continent. We can't stand you. We voted for Hamas. Hamas's ideology is that we will not negotiate your continued existence. We want you out of here. Of course, this was devastating to Israel because they have no intention of leaving. So it'll be chaos there as usual. It probably won't be any different. If Fatah won, Hamas would still be sending bombers into Israel. And now that Hamas has won, they'll still be sending their bombers in. I don't expect any changes whatsoever. A few days later, acting Foreign Minister Zippy Livni appealed to the international community to isolate any future Hamas government. Isn't that disgusting? Hamas wins, and now Israel, after torturing the Palestinian people for 100 years, goes out and tells Europe that they want all of these Europeans to isolate Hamas and the Palestinians and torture them some more. What they're saying is, how dare you vote for the candidate that you want to represent you? We will decide what you want. And, oh, by the way, the election itself was a sham, because we're not going to respect it. We're not going to deal with Hamas. So for now, evidently, it appears that Israel will hold off drastic measures, such as sealing the border crossings with Gaza or cutting off its monthly flow of tax rebates to what has become a cash-starved Palestinian Authority. The new Palestinian government might not be formed for 2 months, giving Israel time to come up with a new policy. Avi Dichter, a former chief of the Shin Bet Security Service and a top official in Olmert's Kadima Party, said Israel must not be rash and must wait to see if Hamas will abandon its violent ideology once it assumes power. But people in Europe and elsewhere are asking, well, what difference does it make? They were bombing Israel before they assumed power. And if they bomb Israel after they assume power, what difference would it make? Dichter raised the possibility of a Hamas about-face, saying, I think it would be illogical, I would even say insane, for Hamas to continue along the extremist line they have been following until today. So here you have the Israelis, who are devastated because they lost, still coming forth with their chutzpah, saying, well, it would be ridiculous for Hamas to remain Hamas, and they think now, just because Hamas has won, that they should change. But Israel, the world, doesn't really work that way. When somebody wins an election, they don't suddenly change and become someone who will work with you. Why should they? They won the election. You'll have to recognize them, and you'll have to put up with it. They are now in a position of strength, and you, Israel, you are in a position of weakness, and you need to get used to it. Now, obviously, those of you in Israel who are used to treating the Palestinians as little children who could be spanked and whose homes can be bulldozed when their little bad children do something to you, obviously that's not going to be the case for you, at least not as easily. And you're just going to have to get used to it. Maybe you'll have a big war there again, and you can stomp on them and push them into the soil and do what you did in the Soviet Union, kill millions and millions of them. You seem to be pretty good at that. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's what you end up doing. I'm not sure if it's the chutzpah of the ADL, the chutzpah of the Jews, or the chutzpah of Abraham Foxman in general. But in Kentucky, the Anti-Defamation League officials today said that Governor Ernie Fletcher does not understand the acceptable boundaries of personal faith and public office. So the ADL urged the governor to publicly apologize for the governor's prayer breakfast, which lacked non-Christian voices. The American Civil Liberties Union jumped into the act, saying that it plans to investigate to make sure the state didn't illegally favor one single religious viewpoint. A Muslim leader called on the Fletcher administration to include all faiths in next year's event. State officials defended their decision not to charge prayer breakfast organizations for use of the Frankfurt Convention Center. So here we have a story about minorities who are tolerated by the majority, who return that tolerance with total intolerance toward the vast majority of the people in the United States of America. As though they're saying, well, you tolerate us to come over here, and we're the Jews and we're the Muslims. Now that we're here, we're going to put the screws on you. We're going to show you who rules. You may be 90% of the country, but we, meaning the Jews who are 2-2.5%, and the Muslims who are maybe 2-2.5%, we, 5% together, are going to tell you that when you have a prayer breakfast, by God, you're going to bring a Muslim and a Jew in, and a Hindu, and all of these other religions. You are no longer going to be able to celebrate your lives as Christians in a Christian country. And we, who are a minority that is so minuscule that we shouldn't even be considered, are going to use your constitution and your laws to thrash you to within an inch of your life. And this is disgusting behavior by a minority of Jewish people and of Muslims who amount to nothing. They don't have the numbers to determine what a country that's 95% non-Jewish and non-Muslim does with itself. It's getting absolutely absurd. Is this the way it's going to be all the rest of our lives and in the future? Are we going to have this balkanization? Are we going to have these people telling us, well, you can't do this and you can't do that now because we live here? If that's true, then maybe we need to consider whether or not we want them to continue to live here. If this is going to be their attitude toward our tolerance to them, that they're going to return it with intolerance, well, then perhaps we as Christians or at least those of us in a Christian tradition, should reconsider whether or not we should allow them to be guests here. This is our country. This is not a Jewish country. Do any of you out there think this is a Jewish country? Perhaps I should take that back. In many ways, it is a Jewish country, since they seem to run the judiciary, the banks, the media, and the government. Maybe it is a Jewish country. It's certainly not a Muslim country. And most of us would have to agree that traditionally it's not a Jewish country. So why should Jews and Muslims be telling the governor of Kentucky, which is a Christian state, in which there are a minuscule number of Jews and an even smaller number of Muslims, and yet they want these Christians to include a Muslim and a Jew, when in fact Muslims and Jews are so tiny a number they shouldn't even be considered? The mounting criticism was largely dismissed by the governor's spokesman, Brett Hall, who said the ADL's call for an apology was ridiculous. He said he would relish closer scrutiny from civil libertarians. He said, "We invite their inquiry. We are blessed by their inquiry," he said. "This isn't Berkeley, California. This is hometown America. The ACLU has no credibility in this matter at all." Well, bless you, Mr. Hall, that you had the kahunas to stand up to these thugs who amount to nothing. They don't amount to any votes at all. If you want to have a Christian ceremony, that's fine. If they want to have a Jewish ceremony, let them run for governor and win and have a Jewish ceremony. If they want to have a Muslim ceremony, run for governor, and then you can decide to have a Muslim ceremony. Hall said that this year's prayer breakfast was similar to past gubernatorial prayer breakfasts, and it's an annual event in Frankfurt and has been for more than four decades. The governor's prayer breakfast frequently attracts leading legislators, lobbyists, businessmen, and judges. Hundreds of people attended the breakfast at the Frankfurt Convention Center. All of those who prayed, read scripture, and spoke were Christians. During the former governor's administration, the breakfast was more interfaith. You see, here we have a governor and a spokesman who have stood up to these thugs and told them, "We don't care what you think." It's about time that we do this. We cannot keep bending over to people and telling them that our country is now theirs to do with as they please when they're only 2 or 3% of the people here. It's my contention that if you're 2%, you should sit in the corner and lick your wrist and be quiet. You shouldn't be harmed. You should have the same rights in the courts. You should have the same right to vote, but you don't have a right, if you're 2%, to tell a majority that's 98%, "We're going to tell you what to do. We're going to make you have Jews at your prayer breakfast." No, you're not going to do that. Now, when you become 98%, Mr. Jewish person at the ADL and ACLU, when you become 98%, then you can determine what kind of a prayer breakfast we're going to have in Kentucky. But until then, you need to sit in the corner and you need to be quiet. You're a minority and you need to act like one. The state of Israel has been used to having its way, and it does things like exile leaders of Hamas when it doesn't like what they stand for. So, in a newspaper article in Rome, exiled Hamas leader Khaled Mashal said that he rejected any suggestion that his radical group Hamas should disarm following its shock victory in Palestinian elections. Mashal said in Damascus that the internationally sponsored roadmap for Middle East peace was unacceptable, and the talk of forming a coalition with the moderate Fatah, which it thrashed in the polls, was premature. "The roadmap is unacceptable," he told the Daily Republica, saying it imposed strict conditions on the Palestinians while asking very, very little of Israel. Mashal, who survived an Israeli assassination bid in 1997, said the radical group would certainly not lay down its arms as long as much of its territory was occupied. "Only force has produced results," he said, citing Israel's recent withdrawal from Gaza. However, Mishal denied his group sought the destruction of Israel, saying its statute had been misunderstood in the West. He was quoted by the Daily as saying that Hamas has not closed the door to dialogue with the Israelis. He said, "It's Israel's current philosophy which is preventing our dialogue. For that reason," he said, "resistance is the only way." Acting Israeli leader Ehud Olmert announced that Israel would not negotiate with an administration that included a terrorist organization, and Olmert demanded the Palestinian Authority act on a pre-election promise to disarm militant groups. He and the newly appointed Foreign Minister Zippy Livni have petitioned the international community in a bid to gather as much support as possible. Meanwhile, Israel threw into doubt its willingness to transfer customs revenue to the Palestinians because the militant group Hamas won the election. "We will face practical problems of how you deal with people that call for the destruction of Israel," Joseph Bakar, Director General at the Israeli Finance Ministry, told the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. Mr. Bakar was referring to customs and value-added tax revenue that Israel collects on behalf of the Palestinians, and which he described as the main source for financing the Palestinian budget. Palestinian Economic Minister Mazen Sinokrot, sitting in the same panel as Bakar, said the Palestinian Authority faced a financial crunch as early as next week if Israel withholds the $40 to $50 million it hands over every month. Sinokrot admitted that Israel was obliged to pay this amount. "So this is interesting. Palestinians are receiving approximately $700 million a year from Israel. But you know and I know that that money is not coming from Israel. That money is coming from the United States of America. And it's being paid to Israel to pay to them. It's up to Israel and the United States to decide whether or not that payment is made. And the United States has said, basically, that we don't believe in democracy. We only believe in it if we win. Since we didn't win, I don't think we're going to pay you." And that's a very, very disgusting attitude for a so-called democracy of 200 years to act. It's a terrible way to act. And it puts our entire democracy and our entire public relations in question around the world. Obviously, Hamas represents the beliefs and the desires of the Palestinian people to be free of the Israeli terror state. And why would they want the terror state to stay there? The terror state has been taking away their land, building fences around them, building a prison around them with a 26-foot-high wall. No other nation is allowed to do that, only Israel. There's a certain satisfaction among many scholars today with the outcome of this election. There's a certain feeling of justice and of something that's overdue, because the Palestinian people have suffered tremendously at the hands of the Israeli thugs. And you and I have seen too many young Palestinians dying at the hands of Israeli soldiers. And we've seen too many photographs of the Israeli soldiers posing over the dead bodies of Palestinian boys as though they had just bagged some sort of wild animal from Africa. And we've heard too many stories of jokes that are told about Palestinians being insects or that they breed like rabbits, and passing around cartoons of them that make them look absolutely absurd. The racism of the Israelis toward the Palestinians is well known around the world. And so it's difficult to have sympathy for people who are that racist and treat other people that way, and then turn around and say that, well, we're Jews and we've been treated that way, and you need to help us because we deserve whatever we can get from you. Israel, in the opinion of many, is nothing but an adolescent that needs to be slapped, spanked, and put down onto a chair and told exactly what to do. Because in many ways, it's been totally out of control for many, many years. There's an old saying that's supposed to be anti-Semitic, that Jews are stingy, that you'll never get a dime out of them. It might go back to way before the radio comedian Jack Benny, who was known for his stinginess and who was Jewish, and everyone knew that he was. So I can't understand why a rich organization like the Anti-Defamation League, which I understand has a budget of $46 million, or at least that's its worth, according to an article I read just this week, guess how much they're offering as a reward for a hate crime attack? Well, you'd think it would be $50,000, $60,000, wouldn't you? No, this group with $46 million in its coffers is offering a $5,000 reward for help in finding a group of men responsible for what's being called an anti-Jewish hate crime attack. Isn't that interesting? The protection of a Jew is only worth $5,000 to an organization that makes $46 million. There were two men that prosecutors say were beaten after being asked if they were Jewish. And so they're searching for the group of men that asked them the question and beat them up. The two Jewish men are 21 years old, and they were simply walking around Lombard Street in San Francisco when they were beaten. But the main point is that an organization so rich that they have $46 million is so cheap that they only offer $5,000, and the media is so frightened of these people, oh, so frightened of them, that they won't even say they're kind of stingy, because that would be politically incorrect. Well, it may be politically incorrect, but it's exactly what the ADL is. They're cheap. And speaking of cheap, over in England, actor Ben Affleck has had to sell a kiss to buy diapers for his new baby girl. Yes, that's right, he sold a kiss to get diapers for his new baby girl. The heartthrob actor, Ben Affleck, was out shopping for month-old Violet, his daughter, with his wife, Jennifer Garner, when he realized he'd left his cash at home. He reportedly picked up some diapers and told shoppers, "I've got to get these or my wife will kill me." According to onlookers, the 33-year-old refused to sell his Boston Red Sox baseball cap in return for some money, but settled on smooching a fan who then offered to pay for the baby items. It was revealed last month that Ben and Jennifer are loving every minute of being parents. And a friend said at the time, "Ben has been changing the diapers, and he's an amazing father, and I don't know if I've ever seen anybody happier. He's already wrapped around Violet's little finger." So there you have it, Ben Affleck, broke and on the streets of London because he forgot his wallet, was able to get some diapers by giving some young lady a kiss. I'm not finished yet with the Hamas election. I probably won't be finished all hour because this is the most important thing that's happened in the Middle East in years. And the rest of the world has been placed into a dilemma about what to do. The rest of the world certainly doesn't want Israel to go back to England or to Germany or to America because nobody here wants them either. We've basically stuck them in Palestine because we don't want them. Nobody wants them because they cause a lot of trouble in France, in England, in Germany, in Russia, and they've caused a heck of a lot of trouble here in the United States of America. They have taken over our government. They've caused us to go into Iraq where our children are being killed. And we're going to lose $1 to $2 trillion on that war alone. Quite honestly, the Jews are not worth that. And they never will be worth that. The victory of Hamas, as I say, has caused a great dilemma in Europe because they're quite afraid that the Jews may get kicked out someday and they might have to take them back. And they don't want to have them back. But they don't really say that. But that's what they're thinking. The Palestinians, by choosing Hamas, have expressed their democratic choice. And it has to be accepted. And these so-called democracies in Europe don't know what to do. Because they're trying to say that democracy is spreading in the greater Middle East. At least that's what they want it to do. And it's the goal of the Bush administration, of the Germans, of the French, of everybody. As though people who live in Arab worlds are open to a democracy when it could be that they're not really the people who should have a democracy. Maybe they're a very religious people and they need to have a theological government. And by trying to make them fit what we do, maybe we are causing more trouble than it's worth. Hamas has always been listed as a terrorist organization by both the United States and the European Union. And unless the group accepts that Israel should exist, it's hard to see how it can be negotiating with either one of these partners. The so-called roadmap to Middle East peace, which of course I believe is a joke, there will never be peace in the Middle East until Israel's gone. And even then there probably won't be peace because there's too many different tribes there. It's a Balkanized area, basically, and always will be. The roadmap is already gathering dust and might as well be rolled up for good. It calls for action against individuals and groups conducting and planning violent attacks on Israelis everywhere. And of course, it only works one way because the Israelis have always been guilty of planning and conducting violent attacks on the Palestinians, but they're able to get billions of dollars from the United States and from Europe because that's just the way it is. It's the unfairness of the world around us. Internationally, the push is on for Hamas to change, but the Hamas leaders have no intention, they say, of changing. So there's your dilemma. President Bush, who said in 2003 that in order for there to be peace, Hamas must be dismantled, now says simply that Hamas is a party with which we will not deal unless it gives up violence and accepts Israel. This is like saying that California will not be negotiated with or paid any of its tax money back if the Mexicans won't give up wanting to take California for Mexico. The quartet of the U.S., the European Union, Russia, and the UN, which collectively drew up the roadmap, has also called on Hamas to end violence and recognize Israel. But Hamas isn't going to do it. There are two broad avenues along which events might take their course. The pessimists will see a further battening down by Israel, further construction of the wall and fence that is being built to separate the Israeli and Palestinian populations, and a continuation of what the Irish writer and diplomat Conor Cruise O'Brien once called the siege, by which he meant the endless confrontation between Israel and its Arab neighbors. According to this view, the Israelis will circle their wagons even more and shut up shop for the duration. Danny Sheck, a former Israeli foreign ministry spokesman who now runs the British Israel Communications Center in London, said, quote, "We are entering a period of extreme uncertainty. The Israeli elections coming in a few months will be affected by this, though how far depends on what Hamas does. How will Hamas handle its victory?" Unquote. The Hamas victory is seen by some as the culmination of the failure to achieve a comprehensive settlement. Moderates from each side came close at Camp David in 2000, and closer in later talks in the Egyptian resort of Taba, but that all fell away. The Council for the Advancement of Arab-British Understanding in London said there had to be talks. Just as Palestinians had to deal with the rejectionist Likud government of Ariel Sharon from 2001, so Israel will have to deal with a new Palestinian government. A complete standoff between Israel and the Palestinians will make an international role redundant, though Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will remain as a point of contact. The optimists will see the possibility of Hamas settling into government, realizing that it is not as easy as it sounds, and continuing a de facto ceasefire with Israel. And if it does, then one can envision discrete contacts as time goes by, especially by the Europeans whose diplomats have been in touch with elected Hamas mayors in the West Bank over recent months. This is all, of course, wishful thinking because Hamas has not shown itself capable of negotiating with Israel, for whom it has a tremendous disgust. You have to remember that Hamas has killed hundreds of Israelis, committed over 50 acts of terrorism, mostly with bombs in Israeli buses. And what happened then to Hamas was that Israel came in with bulldozers and bulldoze down the buildings of the martyrs who were considered heroes. And so no one in Palestine likes the Israelis. They see them as a vicious, thug-oriented population of people who could care less about Palestinians and who have basically made their lives miserable for the past 60 years, ever since 1947. And before then, their lives were not that good with the Israelis, who cheated them out of their olive groves, their orange groves, and whatever else they could get their hands on before they stole the rest of it from them in the 1947 war. I don't think that these people are in a mood to negotiate with thieves who not only stole their lands, but who bulldozed down the homes of heroes, thus throwing their families out into the street. People who act like that normally are not the type of people that one would like to associate with, unless one wants to be murdered on a dark street in the middle of Jenin, which would probably be a certainty for any Hamas leader that would sit down and meet with the Israeli government. You have to remember that in Palestine, there's a war going on. And when there's a war going on, people tend to kill traitors. So negotiations with the Israelis is simply out of the question for anyone who has any association with Palestine or with Hamas. Dissidents within Iran say their country's president is such a crazed fanatic that he will try to usher in the end of the world as we know it. It was not too long ago that gunmen opened fire on the motorcade of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as he toured the southeastern province of Sistan along Iran's border with Pakistan. According to news reports, Ahmadinejad's personal bodyguard and driver were killed in the ambush, but the president was unhurt. The government-controlled media in Tehran attributed the attack to bandits, a term used to denote a wide range of armed groups from drug dealers to opposition guerrillas. But in this case, the attack may have been part of a plot to remove the Iranian president by a faction within the ruling clergy, or perhaps it was an assassination by the Mossad. At least, so believes a Western source who has just returned from talks with top officials in Tehran. The faction seeking to remove Ahmadinejad does not object to the substance of the Iranian president's repeated vows to wipe Israel from the map and destroy America, nor do they believe Iran should abandon its secret nuclear weapons program, top Iranian government officials said, at least according to the source. Rather, they object to the fact that he has made such comments openly and without ambiguity. They believe that his frankness dangerously exposes them to attack from the United States, Israel, or both. The guy is not a politician, the source quoted one top Iranian official as saying. He is certifiably insane, and he's obsessed with the Imam Zaman, the legendary 12th Imam, Imam Mahdi, whom many Shiite Muslims believe will return in the end times after a period of horrific battles, famine, and pestilence. Americans may find it curious that government officials in Tehran, who have actively supported the Islamic Republic for years, object to Ahmadinejad's religious zealotry. After all, this comes in a regime whose constitution declares that the supreme leader is God's representative on earth, whose edicts cannot be challenged by elected representatives. But for more than two decades, Iranian leaders such as former President Hashimi Rafsanjani have walked a fine line between openly defying the United States and conducting covert aggression through terrorists and sophisticated intelligence operations. Under Ahmadinejad, these officials believe that that fine line has been crossed. Ahmadinejad's messianic beliefs and his obsession with the 12th Imam have become an open subject of debate in Tehran. Meeting with his cabinet shortly after taking office last August, the new president reportedly had cabinet members sign a loyalty oath to the 12th Imam, which they dropped into a well near where the Shiite Messiah is believed to be hiding. So there you have it. In Iran, we have a minister who is enamored with the 12th Imam, who is enamored with the idea of no more Israel, who is enamored with the idea of no more America. And why should Iran like America? After all, we set up shop there for many, many years. We supported the Shah, whom the Iranians evidently did not like. And so they voted for the Ayatollah Khomeini with riots until we finally left. And then they had a war with Iraq, which we started. And Iraq was our surrogate power that we used to punish them for kicking us out. So of course they don't like us. They don't like Israel, which they know controls us, as everyone knows, and as you know, if you've been listening to me, or if you've just been watching the media, or looking at the paper, you know exactly who controls us. And it's Israel. It's Israel. But Israel's in a little bit of trouble now, because 14 of the Hamas people who were elected to the parliament are still in Israeli prisons as Israeli political prisoners. People who have broken the law in Israel, who are now ready to be seated in the parliament. Of course, they probably won't be seated because the Israelis probably won't let them go. I have to admit, I kind of like this guy who runs Iran. I like people who have the stones to stand up to the Israelis and to the United States. It kind of reminds me of a mouse bravely giving his index finger to the elephant who is about to stomp him into the ground. To think that there are people out there that no matter what you do to them, no matter how much you beat up on them, their country, and their compatriots, they will still look you in the eye and say, I want you dead. This is a thing to behold. This is a thing of wonderment. This is a thing of entertainment that only comes around now and then. And so when you see it, and you see true bravery in the midst of everybody else's cowardice, you have to kind of look at the guy and say, you know, at least he's a true man, and a good man is really hard to find, especially with all the corruption going on and all the governments around the world, our government, the government of England, the government of Israel, all of these governments, the Palestinian Authority, you name it, they're all on the take, all they want is money, but every once in a while, a man steps up who says, I don't want the money, I don't want the prestige and power. I just want what's right. Gaza City is a very, very interesting place. Not unlike Detroit, where a lot of Arabs live and a lot of blacks live. And in Gaza City, thousands of Fatah supporters, that's the losing party in the Palestinian election, thousands of Fatah supporters burned cars and shot in the air across the Gaza Strip, demanding the resignation of corrupt party officials and insisting there be no coalition between their defeated party and the victorious Hamas. The protest against the Fatah party that dominated Palestinian politics for the last 40 years came after President Mahmoud Abbas, who was elected last year to a four-year term, said he would ask the Islamic militant group to form the next government. Abbas later fired six Fatah officials. Israel's government, caught off guard by the Hamas parliamentary landslide, after its vaunted intelligence services predicted a slim victory for Abbas's Fatah party, said it would have no contacts with the Palestinian government that includes Hamas. So the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority are at an impasse. Abbas can do nothing else but appoint Hamas as the governing body because they won. And if he tried to appoint Fatah, he would have a civil war. Acting Foreign Minister Zippy Livni appealed to the international community not to legitimize a Hamas government, saying that elections are not a whitewash for terror. No one seemed to contradict her or say that Israel had been a whitewash for terror for 60 years. But that's the way of the game in international politics, especially when you're trying to get the Jews out of your country and sequester them into the Palestinian area where they won't bother you anymore. but they'll only bother the Arabs and the Palestinians. A Hamas-led government could lead to a cutoff of crucial foreign aid to the cash-strapped Palestinian Authority. If the Islamic militants do not renounce violence and end their call for the destruction of Israel. And you have to ask yourself, well, why would that be? If these are the true representatives of the Palestinian people, and they won the election because they call for the destruction of Israel, who would the United States be, or England, or anyone else, to tell them that, well, we're not going to pay you what we said we would pay you, because we do not like your government that you elected? This is like saying that democracy only goes so far. And if you vote for someone we don't like, we're going to take our chips and leave. Well, Hamas would like nothing more than the Israelis taking their chips and leaving and going back to Germany and to Poland and to Russia. But Russia, Poland, and Germany have indicated by keeping them as much as possible in Israel that they simply don't want them back. Thousands of these Fatah activists, furious with corrupt leaders whom they blame for the electoral loss, continue to protest throughout Gaza and the West Bank. They demanded the Fatah Central Committee resign and insisted that the party not form a partnership with Hamas. Well, this is like an open invitation to civil war within the Palestinian state, a civil war that would probably delay, possibly forever, again, the creation of a Palestinian nation, which is something the Israelis are probably hoping will happen, so that the finality of a Palestinian national state will not happen in their lifetime. Shamir Mashari, a local Fatah leader who was defeated in the election, said, "We are against joining any coalition with Hamas because this means a disaster for Fatah and the Palestinian people. Instead, we want to be a strong opposition, and we want to fight and end the corruption of some of Fatah's historical leaders." This is par for the course in politics, where people who lose an election decide that they will decapitate their leadership who they believe has let them down. We've seen this in America when people like Kerry lose and people like Gore. Suddenly they're relegated to the dung heap of history, and the party wants nothing more to do with them. Although every once in a while a person like Nixon will once again be nominated and actually make it into the presidency, taking his corrupt party with him. Of course, since both parties are corrupt, whoever gets in, we know we're going to have corruption. And I think it's rather disingenuous of Fatah to think that Hamas will not be corruptible, although actually they seem to, in the past, have been non-corruptible. And Hamas made itself victorious because it cares about the people. It gives people food, it gives people money, it helps them to keep their homes in repair. It takes their children to school. It builds their schools. It does a lot of things on the local level for the people that you would normally see done by churches. And in a third world country in which religion is extremely important, and you have not only Muslims, but 30% to 40% of the Palestinians being Christian, working together, having a party like Hamas helping everyone out is probably extremely comforting. If Fatah had used its power to do that, rather than to squander the money given to it, Fatah probably would have won this election, and this crisis would not have occurred. But that's water over the bridge. That's the way life is, not only in Palestine, but in America and every other nation, where corruption is generally the name of the game. One of the most interesting characters on the world stage today is Condoleezza Rice, who used to be a university professor but now specializes in lying to foreign ministers in Europe and elsewhere. She said on Thursday there could be no Middle East peace process if Hamas, the winner of the Palestinian election, refused to recognize Israel's right to exist, as though that would make any difference. Because in a democracy, whoever wins, wins. But Condoleezza doesn't think that's true. She says you can't have a peace process if you're not committed to the right of your partner to exist. Well, that didn't seem to matter to Russia, the United States, and England during World War II when it came to Germany and to Japan. So in this war, why should it make any difference? She said, I think you will hear the international community speak clearly on exactly those principles over the next day. Ms. Rice said there will be some difficult choices before those in whom the Palestinian people are placing their trust. She was speaking after unofficial election results showed a shock victory for militant group Hamas over the long-dominant Fatah faction, which, of course, as you recall, is a faction that was run by Arafat, whom no one could stand. Now, it's been suggested that the Israelis poisoned Arafat, and it's been suggested that they also poisoned Ariel Sharon. And if that's true, look at the tragedy that is occurring because of the death of both of these leaders. Sometimes you're better to stay with that which you know than that which you don't know. When you roll the dice, you never know what's going to come up. And every once in a while, you're going to get snake eyes. Rice said that the election had been peaceful and fair, with very high turnout, but she said the U.S. position on Hamas, which it considers a terrorist organization, was unchanged. In other words, she's saying, I don't care what these people democratically elected, we're not going to accept their choice. Of course, Ms. Rice is not a Palestinian. And if she were treated as a Palestinian, obviously she wouldn't be the Secretary of State, but she would be sitting in some hovel down south, possibly in Mississippi or maybe up north in Harlem, having absolutely no chance of success whatsoever. But since she's not a Palestinian and being treated like a Palestinian, but being treated as an equal in America, she does have the right to say what she wants and to become the Secretary of State, unlike the Palestinians who are kept down by the Israelis whom Ms. Rice loves to support. Condoleezza Rice said, you cannot have one foot in politics and the other in terror. Anyone who wants to govern the Palestinian people and do so with the support of the international community has got to be committed to a two-state solution, must be committed to the right of Israel to exist. But if there is to be a future that can answer the aspirations for peace of the Palestinian people, then it is going to have to be a future that renounces terrorism and violence. Well, then perhaps, Ms. Rice, you'll have to renounce Israel, because Israel is all about terror and violence and has always been about terror and violence. So, Ms. Rice, I don't know what you're talking about. You're in bed with a terrorist right now. And every day that you go to Israel and sit with the Israelis, you are sitting with the true terrorists who started terror in the Middle East and who try to blame it on everyone else. And Ms. Rice, I think you should be ashamed of yourself for having such a two-faced position. However, it's pretty obvious that that's the way that you are. You have told people in Europe that we have never tortured anybody, when in fact everyone already knows that you have tortured people. And so anything that you say cannot be believed anyway. And so there's no use in going on with this story, because you are a person who is never to be believed, because you are a known liar. Have you ever had this spyware get on your computer where suddenly all of these windows begin opening again and again and again, and you can't get it to stop? Have you noticed your computer's going extremely slowly, and it's because of spyware, which is checking everything that you do and sending messages secretly across your internet wire to some company so they can try to figure out how to market better to you, and they're using your computer to do it without your knowledge? Well, you're not alone, but there might be some help, because the Jews who own these particular spyware companies, and most of them are Jewish, internet researchers at Harvard and Oxford universities are seeking to enlist web users in a new program to name and shame suppliers of spyware and other malicious software programs. Well, that'll be interesting. I don't know if that's going to work or not. I've never noticed that shaming Jewish people has ever done anything to alter their behavior. Look at the ADL and the ACLU. They've been shamed for tens of years, but they continue with their hateful mannerisms that people in the country just don't like. The coalition calls itself the Stop Badware Coalition. It will seek to spotlight companies that make millions of dollars by tricking web users into putting software, adware, or other deceptive software on their machines. It's a multi-year project that is financially backed by Google and computer makers Livono Group and Sun Microsystems. It is advised by U.S. consumer advocacy group Consumer Reports WebWatch. This is mostly a highlighting and warning and education project, said Vince Cerf, one of the pioneers of the Internet, who now holds the title of Chief Internet Evangelist at Google. How's that for a title? Chief Internet Evangelist. Over time, they hope to team up with commercial security software makers to create automated tools to block Jewish-sponsored badware. These tactics seek to go beyond lawsuits and efforts to work with regulators to use the power of publicity to expose what organizers say are unethical practices of aggressive marketers. I'm sure there are some people in this business who are not Zionists or Jews, but it seems that a lot of these folks who get into advertising and bad advertising tend to be from that particular group of people, and that is just the way that it is. Great Britain, or the United States, seems to have bombed Iran in the last week. Most think that it's Great Britain because their troops are closest to where the bombs actually hit Iran. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad claimed during a cabinet meeting that occupying countries in Iraq are connected with the explosions that occurred on Iranian territory. The foreign minister said the plotters of these attacks were obviously supported by London or Basra. The blasts on Iranian territory, in which 8 people lost their lives in Petra City, might allegedly have been targeted at the prime minister and therefore referred to as a warning to Tehran, unwilling to retreat from its nuclear activities. The Iraqi city close to the region where British forces were commissioned experienced several blasts in 2005 as well, and Iran claimed Britain was behind them and had provoked separatists into setting bombs in the area. So here we have a situation that's very explosive in which Britain may very well have bombed Iran. They're certainly not denying it at this point, although I'm sure that they will. That's usually the name of the game. But as we see more and more of this rhetoric about Iran and about Israel and about Palestine, it seems that everything is being ratcheted up again and again and again. And I've noticed that whenever I see this sort of thing happen, a war starts. Whether it's in Korea, or Afghanistan, or Sarajevo, or Iraq, or in this case Iran, this is the first thing that you hear. People talking about someone bombing something, then there's a reprisal, then someone talks about, well, I'm going to make an atomic bomb, or I'm going to do this or that, and pretty soon it gets out of control. You may wonder, as I do, if the Iran nuclear issue is a Mossad deceit to blackmail the United States into higher funding for Israel. And there may be a part of that in everything that we're talking about here. It could also be a part of the Hamas win. Israel would never get a dime from the United States if everything were quiet in the Middle East. And it's only by the creation of chaos or the observation of chaos close to Israel that the United States begins to fund more money for that state. So if there weren't any problems, then their funds would pretty soon be gone. And they certainly wouldn't want that to happen. The world that we live in is dangerous, but it's made all the more dangerous by the Jewish hegemony that we find in our newspapers, in which everything we see comes through the Zionist lens of our Jewish supremacy masters. The people of the master race, who have placed themselves above us, even though they are only 2.5% of the country and we are 97.5% of the country. Yet our leaders, who have proven themselves totally without value to us, but of total value to the Zionists, have sold us out and have made us the vassals of Israel and of the Rothschild banks. And we notice always that in our newspapers, although the Rothschild banks are turning the wheels of the world, that for some reason we never hear about the Rothschild banks. Is there some sort of secret handshake or message that every reporter has to make, or every editor, so that they know that the Rothschild banks are never to be discussed in print? Sometimes you can tell by things that don't happen more than you can tell by things that do happen. One of the things that doesn't happen is we never hear much about terrorism and torture in Israel, although the Israeli Supreme Court has announced in the past that it's okay to torture people, and it's okay that they have 600 to 800 young, mostly Palestinian boys and girls who are being tortured any given month. We do not hear that. And we can learn more from the fact that we don't hear it than we would ever learn from hearing it. Because by not hearing it, we know that our media is controlled by people who appreciate the goals of Zionism. What are the goals of Zionism? Well, it seems that world banking and the colonization of every nation through the fluctuation of its currencies by people like George Soros, who is a Jewish financier, who among other nations has collapsed the currency of a nation as large as China. So that China has told him that he is persona non grata, and anything that he does with them will be done at their protest, and they will not cooperate in selling him anything, because they're afraid that he will once again wreck their economy. He's wrecked the economy of Indonesia, which is a poor country, and each time he wrecks an economy by buying and selling their currencies, he becomes wealthier and they become poorer. He is a leech. He is a scumbag. He is a thug. He has tried to take over the Democratic Party in America, among other things. He gave them millions of dollars last year in his desire to unseat Bush, who he said was basically another Adolf Hitler. It's interesting that someone who can destroy millions of lives by trading currency would himself say that he has a conscience, enough so that he would see President Bush as an Adolf Hitler, and that he was going to take $8 or $9 million out of his $8 or $9 billion, and for public relations, try to change American politics, even though he's not an American and he doesn't belong here. We have to understand that a lot of things that we talk about and that we know about are very important things to know, but that what we don't know, that's what we have to worry about. We don't know right now what the Rothschilds are doing. We don't know what currency right now George Soros is destroying. We don't know what the Democrats are planning or the Republicans in the back corner where they shake hands and meet. We don't know what they're doing in terms of their relationship with the Zionists, who wish world chaos so that the banking industry can make more money off of armaments, which are owned and controlled by Jewish financiers and capitalists, who then make a lot of money selling these goods to our armies and our navies, and who profit from both sides of every war. They'll sell to Iran, they'll sell to Iraq, they'll sell to the Palestinians, they will sell to the Americans. Anything they can make a buck from, they'll sell it to them. The name of their game is make armaments, start a war, rake in the profits, make it through products that you sell to the armies, and also make it through the loans that you make to the government that eventually goes broke and has to stop the war. These are the realities of our world. This is the reality of our mercantile system, which is run by the same Rothschilds who have been running everything for the past several hundred years. who've been behind every war, starting with the Revolutionary War, with the French Revolution, with the Russian Revolution, the Rothschilds, whose name means Red Shield, Rothschild, the people who started communism so they could start more wars, more chaos, so that they would make more money and have better access to the top layers of government, because they're the only ones with the currency which are necessary for wars to be fought. My name is Frank Weltner, and this is The World Today. And I want to thank you for joining me, and I hope that you have learned something today, and that you will think about what we have discussed over the next few days until we have our next program. I want to wish each and every one of you a very nice day.